think there's one in the United Kingdom. There's one in India. I think there's one in Japan. The two we've got in the United States, the ones that are going into space. So gravity waves, now that we've got a direct measurement, extremely well confirmed direct measurement, you're going to be seeing a lot more of this in the future. It's going to give us a lot more knowledge about what's going on. Now, the three solar masses that were lost during this particular event, up till now they've been saying that all of the energy loss was because of gravitational waves being transmitted. I've got another guess. I think that's not the only mechanism of loss. When you've got a black hole and some dust falls into that black hole, that dust at the surface of the black hole gets accelerated to a very high velocity, a very high temperature, emits a tremendous amount of X-rays. Just dust falling onto the surface of a black hole gives you a tremendous amount of X-ray output. Can you drop? What makes a gamma ray burst? This really huge burst of energy you get for a fraction of a second or a couple of seconds. There are people speculating that two neutron stars, a neutron star and a black hole, or a pair of black holes coming together, gives you a gamma ray burst. Here we have, in this particular event, a 36 solar mass and a 29 solar mass black hole coming together. Did they make a gamma ray burst? I am guessing they made one hell of a gamma ray event. And one solar mass is 10 to the 44 joules in a couple of seconds or a fraction of a second. Tremendous amount of energy. So I guarantee gamma ray burst of X-rays and whatever during this event is another one of the mechanisms of where three solar masses were lost. I can't believe all of that was just gravitational wave propagation. So the fact that they never mentioned the fact that when two things like that come together and one crosses the threshold of the other, you get all of this heating and X-rays and gamma ray burst. I'm kind of amazed that that hasn't been mentioned yet. Over to you for any comments on this one, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW, the TechNet.
I did hear the three solar mass story, and, what are you going to do? I'll go with what they're saying for now. I'd like to see some repeated signals come in. That's always good. Anytime they come up with a claim, it's always good to have repeated signals. I know they're convinced that all these are real. You saw the news conference. I think that was the news conference where they talked about one LIGO reception being equivalent to an omnidirectional microphone, and with two, they can start to triangulate it 7 milliseconds apart. And they know this one went off first and that one went off second. And they'd like to have three, of course, more the merrier. Right now there's only two in operation. You do have one in Italy that's due to come online. Bigo. Burgo. Burgo is the name of that one. So another one being built in Japan. It's going to be more sensitive than the LIGO machines because they're going to use some kind of cryogenics to keep it cool. So now they know that all this is possible, and they'll probably, I wouldn't be surprised if there'll be a movement to build more of these detectors. The one in Japan is on the ground. Less of a chance of getting spurious signals. So let me drop it. And then with the spaceborne projects that they have right now, they only have this one on the books. It's a combination of ESA and NASA with the testing of LISA Pathfinder. That's going to eventually lead to the enhanced LISA, and that's the one where it's going to be very expensive. With three separate spacecraft out in space 1 million miles apart, sending laser signals to one another, doing a similar type of operation. And that will be able to actually detect signals. The this one will not. You only have cubes floating inside one spacecraft that are something like, I think they said 40 centimeters apart, with lasers looking at them, able to detect accuracies down to one picometer. So they're going to see how that goes, and if that works out, they'll concentrate on more space-borne gravitational detectors. Problem is, the one that's scheduled, the enhanced laser, isn't going to be ready until probably 2034. You're looking at, you know, 16, 17, 18 years from now. And I think probably because of the cost, in the past 10 years or so, it's been hard to get funding for this type of thing. But now they know it's possible. Who knows? Maybe there'll be a rush for science, and maybe they'll put more money into space-borne and ground-borne detectors. That's pretty much all I have on that. Dick, back to you for any questions, and then if you don't have any more, I'll just go through a couple of items that are also worth mentioning for the net. This is WS2M.
Yeah, this gravitational wave detector is not only a brand new window on astronomy to try to figure out what's going on in this universe, where did it all come from, are we alone in it, and so on. One of the interesting speculations is that gravitational waves have no trouble penetrating a planet, penetrating a solar mass, penetrating anything. So if you have a way of modulating gravitational waves, it would be a beautiful way of sending a message out to space. Hey, are you guys out there? Are we alone? Are the really smart civilizations out there? Are they talking on gravitational waves? It's an interesting speculation. Here we've detected something. Let me think now. 2.5 million light years is Andromeda. Yeah, almost 1,000 times further away than the Andromeda galaxy. Let me think now. How much more of a 0.15? A big number. Long distance. So if we were detecting gravitational waves that came from an event from a much closer galaxy or from within our galaxy, we would have gotten a tremendously bigger signal. So the tremendously bigger signal that we would have gotten from an event like this in our galaxy is such that if you had a way of modulating gravitational waves. And to a degree, they do. Let me drop this. One of the things that happened in the LIGO experiment is that in order to confirm that it really was working, there was a way that they could inject a phony signal. And periodically, they had another group of people intentionally test to do just that, to see whether or not the guys running the machine could really detect. And so, in the very beginning, they were asking the question, hey, was this a phony injection of a signal? And the good news is that the instrumentation that injects the signal was not in operation at that time. It was under some kind of a repair procedure. So therefore, they had that one strong piece of evidence that this wasn't a phony signal, combined with the fact that both Livingston, Louisiana, and Hanford, Washington, the two separate LIGO detectors, saw the exact same event 7 milliseconds apart. It's very strong confirmation that it was real. On top of that, when it comes to a 29 and a 36 solar mass pair of black holes coming together, the computer simulations had generated a very characteristic chirp signal. Let me drop it. So by computer modeling, you know what the signal is supposed to look like. You go to the right website, you will see the real signal that they measured superimposed with the simulated signal that they modeled as to what's supposed to be there. And the fit is beautiful. There must be a 97% correlation factor between the anticipated signal and the real signal. Another very strong piece of evidence that this was a real event. I'd love to know how that instrumentation they use that injects a phony signal. Maybe it just injects a phony voltage. Did they they really find a way of modulating gravity, they're testing instrumentation in order to test out LIGO. I'd like to find out how that works. If they really have a way of modulating gravity, then we've got a way of transmitting signals over very long distances that'll go through stars and planets as if they're not there. So to find a way to communicate with those other guys out there that we know are there. These UFOs, a certain percent of those UFOs might be real. Okay, what else is going on in space in this last week, Paul? WS2N with the space report, number 188, K2IW in the TechNet.
Okay, and there was a good interview with Kip Thorne, the physicist I mentioned earlier, that was also at the National Science Conference. He got on to National Public Radio, NPR, and had an interview with Ira Flato. And so you could go back to Friday's show. It normally comes out at 2 o'clock, but you can go onto the web and bring up National Public Radio, Ira Flato, science. But he was on there for 17 minutes. Things that we said here, and it's good, worth reviewing. By the way, I know Mike is listening. K1 MJM sent me an email regarding something that was on the one of the NASA sites, all about the entanglement of photons and stuff from a distance. You know, spooky action at a distance. Thanks for that. Yeah, and I did see that. He's asked me if I saw that. So, couple of things. One bizarre thing is somebody. I don't know if this is true yet because it might be a piece of space junk. Somebody got killed in India, standing on a corner by a meteorite. I mean, that's it's not been confirmed, but they think that it's probably likely from some of the witnesses. What they heard of, apparently they must have heard the sound barrier, or, you know, loud noise, and somebody got themselves killed. Well, if it's true, it's the first recorded incident of that ever happening. Let me drop it. But I don't want to say anything to be sure, but if anybody sees anything on a reliable website, I'd like to find out if that was true. This week, the JAXA, that's the Japanese Space Association, they're going to launch Astro-H. Astro-H is a space telescope, and pretty large. It's about 27 feet long, and I think they said they use the meters, 9 meters wide, going to be put into orbit, and it's going to detect X-rays, soft X-rays and hard X-rays. Very sophisticated. It sounds like a little bit I read about it. It sounds much more sophisticated than Chandra, which has been operating for the last, 20 years, that we put up, launched by a space shuttle many years ago, which is still operating. So I hope they get that thing operating. It's called Astro H. H as in hotel. Let me drop it. A piece that extends out of it. After it's in orbit, which makes very long. And that's where the detectors are. You're going to have these similar focusing devices, similar to a Chandra with X-rays. If you just had mirrors, it would go right through the mirrors. So these are glazing mirror type of objects, which as they come in, they just hit the sides of these mirrors that are, slightly on an angle, and eventually they get focused together, and they have detectors at the end of this extension piece that comes out. I know we want something similar to that using a Pegasus rocket years ago. This is the same idea, but much bigger. Let me drop it. And next big launch I'm paying attention to will be early March. The, you know, it's not us, it's the Russians. They're launching a Proton rocket, but they're being paid by the European Space Agency to do it. European Space Agency is launching something called the Trace Orbiter and the Schiaparelli Lander. Destination Mars. Trace Orbiter will go into orbit around Mars, and the lander will separate from it and hopefully land in Mars. And they only plan on transmitting like for a half a day, and they have batteries on board. They just want to, it's a proof of concept type of landing vehicle. But the Trace Orbiter will stay in orbit around Mars like all the other satellites that we have. Orbiting Mars, that's going to lead up to another launch 2 years from now, which will be a landing spacecraft rover that will also be launched by a Proton rocket by the European Space Agency. So in 2018, I'll be looking for another rover riding around on Mars. It should be pretty interesting. It's not a, doesn't have a nuclear-powered device on it. It's going to be solar paneled. We'll see how that goes. So, anybody that has cable TV or BIOS, if you look on the Sci-Fi channel on the 21st next week, it'll be actually during the net. Let me drop it. If you have Optimum like me, it's one channel 170. But on the it's on the science station. Not the sci-fi station, but the science station. They're going to have a show called Telescope, and it's a one-hour show talking about the James Webb Space Telescope, which we talked about many times here on the net. And I thought that would be interesting to watch. I'll definitely record that, and I'm sure Channel 13 is eventually going to have something. You know. They always do, and they tend to outshine everybody else when they do it, but for now, Science Channel will have this. That's pretty much it, Dick. Any questions or any information, I can be reached at spacenetreport@gmail.com, or my call letters, ARRL, my call letters was ARRL.net. Back to you, Dick. WS2N.
Okay, thank you, Paul. Good stuff. When it comes to that piece of calibration equipment that LIGO has associated with it, the thing that can inject a phony gravity wave signal to test the system, whether or not it's working correctly, it's got an abbreviation, LSC, Lima Sierra Charlie, which stands for LIGO Scientific Calibration or Calibrator. So you and I have got to find out how the LSC works. How does it modulate a gravity wave that puts a phony signal injected into LIGO in order to test whether the system is working correctly? However that LSC works, we got to build a bigger version of that and aim it out there in space and ask the question, hey, is there anybody out there? Do you hear me now? Saying those words with a gravity wave transmitter would be kind of interesting. Something else I was going to ask you. What in the world was it? I'm looking at my notes. Looks to me like James Webb is coming along very nicely. Still going to be launched in the year 2018. I'm looking forward to that one. Chandra. I think Chandra was launched roughly 2001, 17 or so years ago. And that's the X-ray telescope that's doing a very good job of that. Although I think they've lost some of the sensitivity of the detector on Chandra. I think the detector has slightly degraded in time. But when you look at the sky in X-ray, ultraviolet, optical, infrared, far infrared, radio, millimeter wave, and now gravitational wave, there's lots and lots of kinds of astronomy. This all got kicked off by a guy named Galileo, roughly in the year 1612, roughly 400 years ago. Let me drop it. So there's roughly 400 years of astronomy, including radio astronomy, done in 1932 by Jansky. Jansky, working at Bell Laboratories, 1932, detected radio waves, which we now know is coming from the center of the sun. And along came Groot Reber, a ham in Illinois, Wheaton, Illinois, that built this 31-foot diameter parabolic dish. And using the tubes that were available to him in those days, he had an extremely high noise figure by modern standards. But that particular 31-foot diameter parabolic dish, the real item, got moved to the National Radio Astronomy Observatory, Green Bank, West Virginia, as well as Carl Jansky's Sturber curtain that was running at something like 18 megacycles. He builds this great big antenna. I think the antenna was in the vicinity of 25 feet end-to-end. The Sturber curtain was built on four automobile wheels so that the whole thing could be rotated. And by rotating it, he figured out where this extra noise was coming from that Bell Labs wanted him to find out about, which was affecting the range of their transatlantic transmissions. Let me drop it. And he made those measurements long enough and carefully enough that he realized the direction of arrival of the signals at 18 megacycles was slowly shifting by roughly 1 degree each day. He suddenly realized, hey, that's not a local terrestrial signal. That's an extraterrestrial signal. And so the Jansky unit, in his honor, the basic unit for radio astronomy sensitivity, is named in his honor. So he had this great measurement in 1932, made it, wrote the article, and then dropped the project. Didn't think there was anything there. And along comes Groot Reber, a ham radio operator, tinkering with antennas, who said, hey, radio astronomy, there's something there. It's going to give us another window on the universe other than just the Mount Palomar, which I think already existed in those days, had just been created, and the Mount Wilson optical telescopes. So, you ain't heard nothing yet. Ain't heard the end of the story. There's greater and greater understanding and more strangers being discovered. What in the world? Let me drop. What in the world? What in the universe? Dark energy, dark matter. What does it consist of? Hasn't been detected yet. Some very elaborate experiments are going on trying to deepen in the bottom of minds with the xenon detectors. They're trying to detect dark matter. And there's a hell of a lot of it out there. There's more dark matter than the real observable matter. Where is it hiding? What does it look like? Is it just dust? And dark energy. You guys have heard my theory on that one. They think there's a repulsive force that creates dark energy where all the stuff at the outer perimeter of our observable universe is accelerating away from us. Not only going away from us, but it's going away from us faster and faster in time. Why? Is stuff like that doing that? When it comes to very long repulsive forces, I think there aren't any. I think it's being attracted to the stuff that's in the other universes that are beyond our observable universe. It's being sucked outward, is my philosophy. And I'm not the only one. You can read that in a few places. To think that there was only one Big Bang in the whole history of the universe, and that we're in the middle of that one, another one of our five different levels of arrogance we've had in the past, when we started off thinking that the Earth is the center of this universe. Everything revolves around us, and we're that important. Five times in a row we've been humbled. That ain't true. And we're about to be humbled a few more times. You wait and see. And with any further questions or comments on all of the above, give me your call letters right now. K2RIW in the Tech Man.
Just two comments, WS2N.
Go for it, Paul.
One thing, they were getting emissions, you know, over the years. They realized even if a car, a truck was like a couple miles away, they could see on the fact that the front tire hitting a teeny tiny pothole, and then the rear tire, you know, they have all kinds of driving rules and everything when this thing is working. That's how sensitive the system is. So, breaking one guy says, well, if this doesn't work, we'll have the most sensitive seismometer. The other comment is, if you listen to the podcast, I guess you would call it now, I don't know what you would call it, the broadcast of the NPR show with Kip Thorne, he does mention dark energy. This won't do anything to help us to understand dark matter, but he said he tried to explain it, how it would help us understand dark energy. In the future, when we start detecting these waves, we'll be able to tell something from the waves. I didn't quite get it. I'll have to listen to it again, but he does believe that it will help. Every discovery that comes along, there's so many other things that come out after that. And I'm trying to figure out which would be more of an exciting time to live during the Jansky eras, listening to all the inventions and the electronics that were being invented at the time, or now with all this new stuff coming out, computers and different worlds out there that they keep finding and who knows what. But back to you, Dick, WSUN.
At least one more exciting time that occurred somewhere around 1967, I think it was. Penzias and Wilson at Bell Laboratories, I think at Homedale, with a great big hoghorn, measured the 3-degree Kelvin, 2.73 degree Kelvin background thermal energy left over from the Big Bang with that horn antenna. And I think they were making that measurement in the beginning. I think it was at around X-band frequency. And that horn is now a national resource archive being held and not going to be disassembled. The seismic waves that occur when an automobile hits a bump in the road or a pothole, that shakes the earth. That gives you a P wave or an S wave, similar to a micro-miniature version of a earthquake. That, in turn, shakes the mirror of LIGO. If you went through, when you remember seeing that press release on last Thursday, I guess that was February 11th, at 10:30 in the morning, they had to go through some very fancy techniques for suspending the mirror so that the mirror doesn't get set into oscillation. The mirror is at the end of a 4-kilometer-long tunnel where the laser beam is going to bounce 400 times off each mirror. The extremely minor amount of vibration of a mirror, physical vibration from a seismic wave, from an automobile hitting a pothole a few miles away or a train going by, that's not a gravitational wave, as I understand it, Paul. That's just a seismic wave. The slight problem of LIGO is it's sensitive to both seismic disturbances as well as gravitational wave disturbances. And so with very careful suspensioning techniques on these very heavy, very specially made mirrors, they try to remove as much seismic disturbance as possible. So to modulate gravity, how in the world is LSC, LIGO Scientific Calibrator, works is an interesting question. Just like it would be very nice to see a little bit more about what equipment is being used by NASA in the RFID for recognizing all of the stuff that comes up in the cargo ships. Let me drop them.
Comment and comment.
Okay, the first comment person, give me your call letters and name.
Thank you, Dick. This is KD2IXP. This is John.
Go right ahead, John.
The way I think about this, it's about the Big Bang. It's an explosion. And as you may recall, it's something I know a little bit about, explosions. I don't think there was a Big Bang. I think we are still in the middle of the Big Bang. I think it's an ongoing process.
Oh, there's a lot of evidence of that, John. By way of the so-called Hubble constant, by which you measure the distance of any object that you see in your astronomy measurements, by the Hubble constant, you can predict how fast it's moving away from. fastest-moving ones are the ones that got further away during the 13.7 billion years since that Big Bang occurred, 13.7 billion years ago. So there's a strong relationship between distance and velocity, velocity away from us. What do they call that? I can't think of an exact name right now. Recessional velocity. And so, because all of this material is still moving, and they used to predict that if the amount of material being moved didn't have escape velocity, it would go out there for a certain length of time, just like throwing a ball up in the air, and it would turn around and come back. Big Bang would be followed by Big Crunch, was the prediction. Well, we're slowly discovering that the initial velocity is great enough that almost all the material is going to go away forever, never come back. Particularly the material out at the perimeter, which is now going away from us faster and faster. Only the stuff out at the perimeter, the stuff near us, is slowing down a little bit. So maybe there's going to be a minor crunch way downrange. So yes, you could say the explosion, the event of that explosion is still taking place. It hasn't ended yet at 13.7 billion years. But I'm convinced it wasn't just one Big Bang. 40 billion light years away from us, there was another Big Bang in every single direction, is my belief. Why should we believe there was only one? Just like we used to think there was only one planet, and we're on it, and everything revolves around us. Extreme arrogance we had in the beginning. Is that sort of what you're talking about here, John? KD2IXP, K2LIW in the TechNet?
Yeah, basically, just the way when a bus explodes, there are parts which move slowly away from the epicenter of the explosion, and there are parts that move very, very fast, like the roof, and they just keep going and they're gone. I think that's what we're living through. I think we are at the not at the epicenter, but that we're part of a big bang, which is continuing. It's part of the explosion process. And I'm very interested to see what this gravitational discovery will show. Things like dark matter and you know, anti-gravity and so on and so forth, they're all easily explainable if you consider that. Let me drop this. KD2IXP. I think they're all very explainable if you consider that it's still an ongoing process and that we are witness to the universe unfolding. That's a very exciting thing for me anyway. KD2IXP.
Now, there's a correlation here between radio astronomy and gravitational wave detection in my mind. Some of the really big radio telescopes were so big you couldn't steer the antenna very easily. Like the great big, the big ear at Ohio University, Wesleyan University in Ohio. Anyhow, this great big antenna, which I think was 150 feet wide, could be steered in elevation only, not in azimuth. So you steered it due south at some elevation and left the Earth's rotation once every 23 hours, 56 minutes, and 4 seconds. That's a sidereal rate. So you let the Earth's rotation sweep a path across the sky, and you make measurements, and you get some beautiful radio astronomy measurements. It's called the Meridian Transit Telescope. The Earth rotation does your azimuth rotating, and you just select the elevation from day to day. Okay? If we have a sensitive enough gravitational wave detector, which of course is so big, 4 kilometers in each of two directions, you ain't going to steer that thing. Let me drop it. But if it has enough sensitivity of measuring gravitational waves, let the Earth's rotation steer your antenna pattern of your gravitational wave detector. When you've got two of them, one in Washington and one in Louisiana, and by the time you get a few more of them in Italy, United Kingdom, India, Japan, maybe eventually there'll be one in South America and Africa. As you get a big enough array of these things, and as the Earth rotates, and you measure their gravitational wave detection, it is another kind of meridian transit. You'll now measure the strength of the spatial gravitational waves versus elevation and versus azimuth. That's a beautiful way of detecting where is all the mass out there in space. And will that allow you to see the uniformity of the dark matter, the dark energy, and so on? Are some of those directions continuously being modulated? Of course they are, because there are more binary stars than there are unary stars. And there are even some trinary stars all going around each other. And they're making gravitational waves. As we get enough sensitivity, we're going to detect all of that. So you're eventually going to see the equivalent of a radio astronomy map of the sky, but it's going to be mapping gravitational waves. I think we can predict within the next 10 or 20 years we're going to see that. Let me drop it. So that's more information about how do we fit in, what's out there, how far away is it, how are we alone, where did it all come from, how did we get here? These are real deep questions. Yeah, you can't earn a dollar with that. It's not going to put the bread on your table, so to speak. The salary you get from a company that you work for that's doing that work, yes, at least for a short period of time. But there's a certain kind of human being that really loves doing pure research. That if a question occurs in their brain, by some means, somebody has got to answer it. Whenever you answer a question where you previously didn't know something, eventually somebody finds a way of using it. New information is always useful, even if it's on what looks like a frivolous subject. So, is this sort of what you're getting at here? In other words, there's a relationship between analyzing all the parts that come from an explosion, or analyzing all the stuff that's already out there from the Big Bang explosion, and now we are eventually going to be analyzing them in a gravitational wave manner. In the work that you've done, you find all those fast and slow moving parts, figure out how big, how far, how fast they were moving in order to get there, and when, at least in a computer model, you put them all back together, you figure out where in the bus was the original explosion, how big was the explosion, what did it consist of, study the chemistry and the distribution, and you eventually get a lot of information about the remaining particles. Is that roughly what has been taking place, John? KD2IXP, K2IW?
I believe so, Dick. I think that at some point that you're going to see a rays like Arecibo all over the world doing this. And I think that for every answer we get, being human, we're going to come up with 10 more questions.
That is the nature of pure research. And there are people that get real excited about doing pure research. There are people who know they could earn more money working in some other occupation. But the excitement of blazing a brand new trail, finding some brand new piece of information in some area of pure research, turns them on. And they're willing to do that even at a sacrifice in salary. I've met a few of those people, and they're interesting to talk to. Wes, N2XJN, K2IW, go ahead, Wes.
Yeah, N2XJN. I have a question in regards to the validity of certain phenomena that is taking place here. If the light travels exactly the same distance to both arms to the combining light waves, it interferes destructively, canceling each other. So no light is observable for the detector, but if gravitational wave stretches one arm and compresses the other, the two beams would no longer be able to strike. So, actually, when I look at the way that the instrument is done, I see that they operate in a way with which gamma ray burst should not by any way go in conflict with the gravity wave. I've got the email from Dr. Royce. Let me up. Gravity wave black hole merger might coincide with the gamma ray burst. When I'm looking at the material that is set on the first set of the material that was sent to us, it clearly says that it operates on the frequency of 3 hertz. So the laser beam is far away from, even though there are photons, from being able, or the laser light. Oh no, they even told that the laser light is 1,064 nanometer. That's far away from the gamma ray frequency. I would love if Dr. Ray would say something or more about it. And to explain.
Yeah, Dr. Roy just sent us a mail to you and me. Okay, I'm trying to figure out the, at 11:34, very recently, and I haven't had a chance to read gravity ray calibration, photon calibration. So, Roy, are you on frequency? Alpha Charlie 2 Golf Sierra, K2LIW. Go ahead, Roy. Wes, you've had conversations over the air on 2 meters with Dr. Roy, is that true?
That is correct, but I had a beautiful piece of the material that was prepared by me on the principles of operations legal system, and I'm trying to get to that part. Okay, this way it would explain a lot. What I suggest is you continue with it, and when I find that material, it's pretty straightforward, could be understood by anybody. I come back and reform my question. That's what
we've got about 7 minutes left. I see that Mike number two has also sent us a couple of emails. And was that sent tonight? I'm about to find out when they were sent. Yep, 11 o'clock tonight. And Columbia physicist, supergiant, fast X-ray, transient. Okay. Which maybe is related to gamma ray burst. Yeah. These gamma ray bursts, the last I knew, there was still a huge mystery. They seem to be occurring a couple of them per year. Maybe it was one per month. And they come from all crazy directions. They come from extremely long distances, many galaxies away, so to speak. And what in the world can create an amount of energy equal to a whole bunch of the stars in a galaxy all going supernova simultaneously? That's approximately the amount of energy you get out of a gamma ray burst. What in the world can create that? Let me drop one. I remember I was at a meeting of the National Radio Astronomy Observatory, Green Bank, West Virginia. Oh, this is way back in 1995, 98, somewhere around there. And a couple of radio astronomers knew that I was a person with supposedly some antenna smarts, and they asked me, could I design an antenna for them that could have a whole lot of gain in every direction at once, so they could hear gamma ray bursts with a radio telescope. I remember telling them, not within the laws of physics of this universe. The way you get gain out of an antenna is to aim it like a flashlight. You got some kind of a concentrator, like the parabolic surface on a flashlight, which means that as the beam gets more and more narrow, you get more and more gain. As the beam gets broader and broader, you get less and less gain. And they were asking me to design an antenna with a whole lot of gain in every direction at once. Well, there is a way you can do that. Let me drop. If you want an antenna dead north, you can design an antenna with high gain that's aimed with a very narrow pencil beam dead north. Another antenna dead east, another antenna dead west, and so on. So if you're willing to use 41,000 antennas, I can give you 41,000 antennas with high gain in every direction. That's a lot of investment. That's a lot of hardware. But would any one antenna. It's a conflict. It's a trade-off. You can't get gain and omnidirectional characteristics simultaneously. True isotropic antenna is the lowest gain antenna in the world that has no loss. So that's why it's used as a reference. Isotropic, dB over isotropic, is a typical microwave measurement. Okay, we've only got about 4 minutes left.
I have...
You've got a 4 minute subject? Better make it 3 minutes. Over to you, Wes.
Okay. We're sounding like a crisscross with the laser light. And that's the LIGO interferometer. If the light travels exactly the same direction in both of those arcs, the two combining light waves interfere destructively, canceling each other. Other so that no light is observed on the photo detector. But if gravitational waves slightly stretches one arm, the two beams. Which in return the gravitational wave. Now, when I take the wavelength of the laser, which is 1,064 nanometers, article that he sent us, and I would love to get you forward with that article in the next technet address him.
The person doing all that mischief shows up beautifully on the map. Amazing, he's got the nerve to keep doing it. Whether or not we can discuss that subject next week, Wes, can't give you a yes or a no on it. We've got John and I and others that are part of the technet have got to make a decision as to whether or not it's close enough to the subject that ham radio operators are interested in. Yes, ham radio operators are, to some degree, basic scientists that are interested in a lot of subjects. So there's a little bit of a limit. And so we've got a combination problem of is there enough interest, and there is also enough understanding of the language, the accents, if you know what I mean. We get a fair amount of flack when long transmissions take place with a person with a fairly heavy accent. John and I get a lot of flack on those kind of transmissions. You guys have just heard technet number 1589. 1589, a series that began September of 1982. We think we'll be back next week, settling a few more of these things. And so I'll pass it over to John. And John, I have forgotten, please remind me, roughly how many years ago did you become coupled formally to the TechNet and become one of its huge supporters? Did you start roughly 10 years ago, John? KC2WGB, the Tyson Ribbons. KC2IW, the TechNet. Thank you.
KC2WGB. I believe it was 8, Dick. 7.5, 8 years, something like that. My pleasure, too. It's been a wonderful experience. And just great things. I mean, like Paul with the space report and all that great information we get in here. And tutelage on all of the antenna stuff and all the... I mean, everybody brings their expertise here. And it's very good. I get great emails about people appreciating this, even though they don't ask questions or, you know, they don't come on the air. They're out there for sure. This is KC2WGB. I'd like to thank everybody for joining the TechNet and for the questions that were sent in, and for your monitoring. It's always a pleasure to serve. Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
I'm going to give you guys one more caveat. I, for one, express a fair number of opinions during each checknet. Got to be a little bit careful. There's no guarantee that what you've heard is always accurate. We know Don well. Nobody bats a thousand. There's a certain error rate in everything you hear. However, this is to a certain degree peer-reviewed material. Every bit of it by way of mic number one gets recorded, and it's on a website. You can play it back. KC2NJI, that mic, Perry. And as such, when we make errors, somebody indicates it real fast. Roy, among others, indicates our errors to us real fast. We get a chance to correct it. So be careful with the material you use. It's a little like a Wikipedia report in the very beginning. Wikipedia, in my opinion, is an extremely good resource. There are people who are scared to death because they're afraid there are errors there. In the beginning, there are. People who read it, an expert will come along and say, hey, you guys in Wikipedia said this, you should have said that. So it gets corrected. It gets better and better in time. We'd like to believe the peer review process taking place with the TechNet is somewhat similar. So there are people who get quite angry about the fact that I express to Don many opinions. Let me drop a call. And I use vocabulary that makes it sound like I'm the authority on each one of these areas, and I'm always right. I'm telling you, I'm not always right. As an engineer, I had a certain error rate. And the best thing you can do when you find one of these errors is to laugh at yourself and say, this is the human condition. Profit from the error and the correction of it, and go on from there. If you think you're going to live a life with absolutely no risk and no errors, you ain't going to live at all. You'll never get out of bed, and even that's dangerous. Bye-bye, you all. Keep your eyes to be clear.
Hey, Dick, I found the same thing to be true. If you want an engineer who doesn't make mistakes, you better get somebody else. Have a great time. KC2WGB clear.
And you better provide an access into HCN.
K2RIW NY2H.
Hey, Lou. Lou, one of the first questions I've got, and it's a damn forgetful, the individual little things that I can plug into my computer that allow me to make a receiver out of it, a chip, a dongle. What do you guys call those things? What do you, Lou? K2RIW.
All right, so we call them tiles, but what it is a Raspberry Pi computer and an SDR dongle. The reason I called you is I found a PDF. It's got lots of pages. It's written by somebody from Caltech, and it describes the actual error injection that's used in the LIGO. So maybe I can. It's very voluminous, but maybe I can extract the section that does that and send it over to you.
Thank you. Tiles. I've heard the word before, and I'm so forgetful. Those beautiful tiles do a great job. Well done. And if you can send that as an email, don't even worry about extracting it. Send that as an email. My call letter is arl.net. We'll get it to me, Lou. Glad you found it. So you found information on the LIGO Scientific Calibrator, or Calibration, LSC. And are they really modulating the mirror, modulating a signal? Or are they really creating a gravity modulation? To make a gravity modulation, I could think of a way of doing it. A minor version of what was done by Mr. Cavendish. Mr. Cavendish had these two large masses on the end of a T-bar that was suspended from a fiber. The fiber was a torsional fiber. Let me drop it. And by calculating the amount of rotational, what's the word I'm looking for, torque, created by the two masses at the end of the T-bar coming near two other masses that are in the fixed position of the system, he was able to measure the gravity constant. So I could see how if I had a pair of large masses on a T-bar that rotate somewhere in the vicinity of LIGO, it is going to make a gravitational wave modulation that should be detectable. Depending on the spacing of those two masses, the magnitude of those masses and the range of them to the LIGO, they make a calculatable amount of gravitational wave modulation. So what those two super, black holes did in space, you and I, on a small scale, can do that on planet Earth. I'm guessing that might be their calibrator. Am I even closer, Lou? NY2H, K2RIW?
Yeah, so my very brief reading of it, I'm using my phone to do this, and it's, you know, I've got to magnify it, and et cetera. They do talk about an end mass. They do talk about what real gravity wave signature would look like, and they back into that, and they inject voltage into the control loop, which apparently they do reference this end mass, so they probably affect the end mass as you're saying. I really don't have an understanding of it. So they back into it, and then they actually inject into the control loop. So I don't know that they're doing anything. I doubt that they're modulating any kind of gravity waves, you know, as you speculated. It's quite a system. I mean, they have a seismograph, a very sensitive seismograph involved, too. So I was, you know, first speculating before I found this that maybe they were, you know, fudging with that correction signal. But apparently there are a lot of ways they could probably do this. But, yeah, so there's some voltage, or there's a control loop that, like that's somewhat what they're doing. But, again, I have a very limited understanding of it at this point. But I did find it, and I'll send it to you. It's rather voluminous. I hope it does survive the email, but I'll give it a shot.
Pick you up in a minute, sir. You don't have to send me the raw material. You can send me the URL to it. Who is that just joined us? Was that Roy? K2RIW listening?
The saying goes, better never than late, I guess.
Okay. I may have guessed correctly, Roy. Roy, if you were going to make a calibrator for LIGO, how would you do it, Roy? Go ahead.
Yes. Well, I sent you a link to a very short description of how they do the optical calibration. Apparently, they inject a modulated laser signal, and they use the radiation pressure of the modulated laser signal to emulate the chirp of a gravitational wave.
Fantastic. But now this creates a little bit of a problem. That is, what was I about to say? The problem that's created is you're using the momentum of a laser beam, which implies that the photons have mass. And yet the way a optical wave gets slowed down by the glass of a magnifying glass and then speed it up again as soon as it leaves implies that the photon has roughly zero mass. So if the laser beam is physically moving a mirror by way of its mass, it now asks the question, does the photon have mass or not? Maybe the answer is the mass it has is so extremely light, but it's not zero. And the radiometers that you and I can buy don't measure photon pressure. Do something very different, as you know. Although it is possible to build a radiometer in a container that has a hard vacuum, but I think you get a hell of a lot less force out of it than the radiometers that you and I buy that have really, they're accelerating the air inside. AG2GS, K2RIW. Okay, alrighty. So a photon has zero rest mass. It's got an apparent mass when it's moving. When that light wave leaves my magnifying glass and goes back into air, and it appears to instantaneously speed back up to the speed of light in air, who supplies the force to take that photon mass and accelerate it? AG2GS, K2RIW? Yeah, I missed up the beginning of that. So now, let me repeat the question. You may have already asked, but I didn't answer, but I didn't hear it. When that light wave leaves the glass of